I'd like now to welcome to the program Michael Smith. He's a retired chemist. He is a writer living here in Santa Fe. And he is teaching a workshop tonight. It's called Confluence, Patterns in Poetry, Mathematics, and Nature at the Genoveva Chavez Community Center. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
So you are a chemist and you are a writer very interested in poetry and very interested in the connections between the underlying mathematical patterns in nature and the beauty that we see around us, whether it be in images or in writing. And on some level, I have to say, it's a deep mystery to me why the things that we see as beautiful, like poems or flowers or mountains, are so describable in the language of mathematics.
Well, mathematics is just one of many languages, like Spanish, Italian, Norwegian, Cambodian. It has a particularly powerful twist to it in its ability to describe and predict.
What do you mean?
I can take a mathematical formula, you know, say from physics, and throw a baseball in the air and predict where the ball would land. Okay, that might be more difficult to do, the prediction side of it, to do in any other language. But mathematicians and scientists have agreed upon a construct of what mathematics is. And for example, the number one means exactly that, one. It doesn't mean 14. So there's that power of agreement built into it.
Is all mathematics based in nature? So when you think of one, you think of, you know, one apple or one toe or whatever. One, you think of a unit that you can see and pick up or whatever. Is all mathematics like that?
Boy, that's a really good question. I don't know the answer to that one. I do know that oftentimes in the sciences, the mathematical equations, theoretical equations, will lead to experimental observations. So in a sense, the mathematics leads the observation.
That's very interesting. So people figure out stuff in theory that turns out to have a practice rather than the other way around.
And turns out to exist. For example, in the news last week of finding the Higgs boson,
right,
which was predicted 50 years ago. The mathematics predicted it. This goes on and on. One of the famous scientists from the turn of the century predicted the neutron in mathematics and the existence of the neutron. And it wasn't shown until 50 years later.
Amazing.
That the neutron existed. But the mathematics showed it had to be there in order for an atom to be stable.
So you have these mathematical patterns and these mathematical constructs like pi, mm-hmm, or many other things that you learned maybe in geometry class or in high school math or maybe in college calculus or whatever. What does that have to do with poetry?
Well, many of the poetic forms are based in or have a mathematical form behind them. For example, a haiku. Let's just start with something that we think is simple. You know, haiku typically has 17 syllables. 575.
Although I've heard that in Japan they don't really stick to that as closely as we do here in translation land.
Well, you know, when it comes to forms, beginning writers tend to think that they have to stick to the form.
Right.
But oftentimes the beauty in a haiku or in a sonnet is a slight disruption in the form, and that it's pleasing to the ear. Number one. Number two, just, you know, literarily it makes more sense.
So back to the haiku. You've got 17 syllables.
All right, 575, prime numbers. Okay. What's special about this? I don't know, to be honest with you. However, when the Japanese developed the form, it must have been pleasing to the ear. There was some symmetry there.
And so the thing is, and this is where the skeptic in me says, a line in poetry is pleasing to the ear because it's a prime number, give me a break.
No, because the syllable count is a prime number.
I know, but why?
I don't know. I don't have the answer to that question. The best that I can answer that question is that we're products of nature. And perhaps one can make an argument nature is a product of the underlying mathematics. Nature has to satisfy the mathematics. If it doesn't, then it doesn't exist.
So the workshop you're giving tonight it's an introduction to patterns in poetry, mathematics, and nature, and it's about poems about special numbers and Fibonacci poems. So talk about poems about special numbers. There are people who've actually written poems about pi, 3.1415926 5, whatever it is.
Yes, Wisława Szymborska, the Polish Nobel laureate in literature, wrote a beautiful poem about pi, and it's just titled Pi.
Do you want to read it?
Yeah, well, it's lengthy. I'll read a couple of lines from it, but first let me introduce pi.
Okay.
Pi is, if we take any circle and divide the circumference of the circle by the diameter, we get the number pi. It doesn't matter the size circle. We get the same number. To me, that's poetry in and of itself. There's something special about circles. No other geometric form, to my knowledge, has something like this. If you take a rectangle and divide the length by the width, you're going to get a different number depending upon the size of the rectangle.
Right.
The only case that I can think of where that would be true would be a square. And then length divided by width is 1.
Right.
And doesn't matter.
And there are certain kinds of rectangles that have a particular proportion to...
The golden rectangle.
Which is something
I would talk about in later workshops, because there's the mathematics to the golden rectangle.
Exactly. And the golden rectangle is a particularly beautiful to look at shape, which is also like, really? Are you sure? Why?
I don't have the answer to that.
Yeah.
It's just the way it is. But it's something artists have capitalized on.
Right.
Right? Okay. So anyway, pi is an example of what's called an irrational number. It can't be written in a fractional form. So for example, 0.5 can be written as 1/2, 5/10, 5,000 over 10,000.
Right.
Okay, there's a decimal equivalent to the fractional form. Pi doesn't have a fractional equivalent to its decimal form, so it's called an irrational number. It just goes on and on and on.
It goes on forever.
It's been calculated to 5 billion or 7 billion digits,
right,
using supercomputers, and people are still trying to do this. There's good reasons to do that calculation in number theory.
Really?
Yeah. Uh-huh. But it turns out if pi has a repeating pattern to it, if it ends up showing to have some repeating pattern to it.
It hasn't yet.
This may lead to other discoveries in science or fundamental understanding about the universe. But so far, it doesn't have a repeating pattern.
Right.
Which is a beauty. You can't predict what the next digit's going to be at all. So anyway, this poem by Wisława Szymborska, with the idea that pi just keeps going on and on and on. I'm just going to pick it up in the middle of the poem. It goes on across the table, through the air, over a wall, a leaf, a bird's nest, clouds, straight into the sky, through all the bottomless, bloated heavens. Oh, how brief, a mouse tail, a pigtail, is the tail of a comet. How feeble the stars ray, bent by bumping up against space. And then she ends the poem. It's far from final. 7, nudging, always nudging a sluggish eternity to continue.
So we're talking to Michael Smith about his work on confluence, patterns in poetry, mathematics, and nature. And you spoke a little while ago about how you have theoretical mathematics that ends up we find out later has analogs in reality and in physics and so on. Do you find that there are poets who come up with ideas that turn out to have analogs in physics and mathematics?
I haven't encountered any, but we know that science fiction writers have been very good at this over the last century. This is not to say that poets haven't trod ground before that hasn't been trodden by others. Somewhere in the depths of my brain, I recall a reference there of poets walking on that earth first.
Right.
And that the scientists...
And artists as
and,
well.
And artists, yeah.
Visual artists.
Yeah. And let me add a caveat here. Often when I say poets, in my space, I'm thinking visual artists, musicians too. Back somewhere in the recesses of my brain, someone has this beautiful quote out there of poets and artists walking on the ground first, and then the psychologists discovering it, and then the scientists.
Right. Which is, it makes one wish that they would all talk to each other a whole lot more.
Yeah. Yeah. And in a sense, this is one of the things I'm trying to do with my workshops is to open up the discussion and to bring more people in. So, I hope artists show up. I hope scientists show up. I hope anyone who just has a curiosity about anything like this shows up.
Now, you are teaching tonight about poems about special numbers and also what are called Fibonacci poems. And the Fibonacci sequence was made famous perhaps by what I would call the worst novel of its time, The Da Vinci Code, but it was in terms of how it was written and everything, but it was very compelling to so many. It was made into a movie. What is the Fibonacci sequence?
Well, the Fibonacci sequence is based on something called Pascal's Triangle, which I won't go into. At the workshop, I talk about Pascal's Triangle. It has it's a beautiful series of numbers that is very predictive in the world of mathematics. But if you take Pascal's triangle and do a little bit of manipulation to it, you get the Fibonacci sequence. And the Fibonacci sequence starts with the two numbers 1 and 1. And then the next number is 2.
Because 1 and 1 is 2.
Yeah. So if you add 1 plus 1, you get 2, which is the next number of the sequence. If you add 1 plus 2, you get 3, which is the next number in the sequence. If you add 2 plus 3, you get 5. 3 plus 5 is 8.
And so on.
Okay. It sounds like a cute thing to do.
Right. It's the kind of thing that you do when you're bored in class in the third grade.
Yeah. Yeah. So a bunch of third graders have discovered the Fibonacci sequence.
I mean, seriously.
Undoubtedly. It turns out that the Fibonacci sequence is replicated in nature. For example, in the packing of seeds in a daisy or in a pine cone. In the way a pineapple arranges its petals. In all these cases, the petals, the seeds, are arranged in spirals. And if you count up the number in the spiral and work your way out, imagine being in the center of the daisy and working your way out, the succeeding layers in the spiral are a Fibonacci number. In the sequence. Now,
so it turns out there's one little seed in the middle, and then there's 2, and then there's 1 plus 2 is 3, and then there's 5, and then there's...
Yeah. And the spirals work themselves in clockwise and counterclockwise directions.
Right.
And it's still a Fibonacci sequence. Now, of course, every daisy's not going to be this way. Every pine cone's not going to be this way. There's going to be some variation.
Like there's variations in the haiku.
Right.
As we talked about earlier.
Yeah. But the majority of them are. All right. People figured this out a long time ago. And perhaps that someone wrote down the Fibonacci sequence and two people got together and compared notes and went, look at this.
Yeah. And so what are Fibonacci poems?
A Fibonacci poem takes the Fibonacci sequence and can do one of several things with it. This one that's a favorite of mine by Michael Johnson, every line of the poem is a syllable count along the Fibonacci sequence. So the first line has one syllable, the second line has one syllable, the third line has two, the fourth line has three.
And so on and
so on and so on and so on.
And does that, okay, so we see that that's true of this number sequence, we see that it's true of the inside of the daisy or the pine cone or the pineapple, when you look at it, and those things, I have to say, I mean, pineapples and the insides of flowers and pine cones really are very beautiful. Do the poems come out having that beauty to them just by using that number sequence?
In my mind, they do. Yeah. And as I tried to say earlier, or explain earlier, the sound of the poem, there's a rhythm to this. Poetry started out as a spoken form. And we talk, and perhaps as a dance form, and we talk about metrical feet, the number of syllables per line. And, you know, if people are dancing to a rhythm, it's easier to remember. There's something really satisfying about this. So, in this particular poem by Michael Johnson, Fibonacci Timelines, it's a description of objects in nature, and I wouldn't, as far as a poem, as far as a poem having a meaning or an underlying meaning, this one doesn't have it. But it's a beautiful description of objects that one might find.
Do you wonder, so this is a Fibonacci poem that you're about to read?
Yeah, yeah. So I'll just read the first six lines, okay? Cat's claw curl, pine cone swirl, goat's horns turn, nautilus's shells homing out, pineapples whirl. And
that's to those syllables have those numbers.
Those lines have those syllable counts.
Right.
1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8.
Et cetera.
Et cetera.
Yeah.
And the poem just grows and grows and grows.
Right.
Okay. And of course he has to stop it at some point.
Are there physical limits, or what determines the physical limits to, for example, you have a Fibonacci sequence occurring in nature, whether it be in a flower or a fruit or whatever. At a certain point, it stops growing. It doesn't grow infinitely. What are the physical limits to that?
Well, I'm not a biologist or a geneticist, but certainly the amount of raw materials available,
right?
The amount of energy, the amount of sunlight, water, nutrients, that
right.
kind of thing.
Which some analog of that would limit the length of the poem too.
Right, right, and. At some point, you could imagine an organism getting big enough it couldn't feed itself.
Right.
So there are those kind of limits. If you want to extend this to a mountain chain, what's the limits to the size of a mountain chain growing? Gravity.
Right.
And erosion.
And it turns out mountain chains are also limited by, describable by fractals.
Mountains are described by fractal mathematics, which is something I'll talk about in a later workshop. There's a whole branch of poetry called fractal poetry. What a fractal is based on an equation that iterates itself. And you take an input, you put it into the equation, you get an output. You take that output, you put it back into the equation, you get another output, and it just keeps reiterating, reiterating, reiterating.
And that's a fairly simple mathematical formula, and it results in,
beautiful.
Mountain ranges, what else?
Coastlines, snowflakes, the rings of Saturn. All of these can be described by fractal mathematics. There's plenty of artwork that's Jackson Pollock's paintings have been, some of his paintings have been determined to have a fractal form.
You're kidding.
No. They've been digitized and then subject to computer analysis, and there's an underlying mathematical basis. He didn't realize this when he was doing it, of course.
Right.
But there's something
which
about
is, there's a beauty to that.
There's a beauty to that. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, you are a chemist. You're a retired chemist. Did you come into this, all these analogs to art and poetry later in life, or was that part of the beauty of chemistry for you all along?
Well, back when I was an undergraduate, I wasn't sure if I wanted to be a writer or a scientist. And I went the technical route. Writing was always in the back of my mind. And then eventually, I think I developed enough life experience that I was able to tackle writing. And so I started writing about 12 years ago. And I just started writing poems. Of course, they weren't very good. But I did a lot of reading, took workshops, and just write and read and write and read and write and read. And so that's how I got into it.
Do you think, I mean, obviously, if you want to become a good writer, you have to do a huge amount of reading. It turns out maybe that looking at nature and internalizing mathematics and science might also help your writing?
Oh, no doubt about it. In my case, math and science just work their way into their poems through subtle metaphors. And for example, recently I just read, scientists have shown that the aurora borealis has a sound associated with it. We're just used to thinking of the aurora as being these pretty lights, right? But the aurora makes a sound. And I incorporated that fact into a poem.
Very interesting. Unfortunately, it's time to go, but we want to let people...
Infinity goes on.
Infinity.
Pi goes on, E goes on.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Michael Smith is a retired chemist. He's a writer, and he's teaching a workshop tonight at 7 o'clock at the Genoveva Chavez Community Center. And it's part of a larger series called Confluence, Patterns in Poetry, Mathematics, and Nature. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.